morning. My name is Tom Delato. I am officially called the Director of Safety and Compliance. I'm with Suntex Marinas out of Dallas, Texas, based in Newport, Rhode Island. I oversee safety, compliance, OSHA, permitting, as well as workman's comp for the portfolio, which consists of about 40 marinas right now. I've been in the industry since I was 20 years old. I started out as a technician. I've worked in all the departments, service manager. I'm a certified marina manager, certified service manager. I'm also a certified OSHA trainer. So I've got a lot of credentials, and I do have a lot of experience. I've seen pretty much basically anything you can possibly foul up in a marina. I think I've either been involved with or seen. Good morning. So what we're going to do today is we're going to run through OSHA from the perspective of what I see not only on Suntex marina properties, but on marina properties in general out in the world, because I do spend a lot of time for some reason wandering around in other people's properties. Come on in, gentlemen. Yeah, it's a sickness. It's a sickness. Went with my wife recently to Charleston, South Carolina, and she wanted to go out shopping with her girlfriend. She's like, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to go look at City Marina. She looked at me like I was out of my mind, but she does that a lot, so there's that. Just want to touch on a few things with OSHA. What we try to do, or what I try to do, is I try to impart as much knowledge as I possibly can to my teams out in the world. Not necessarily beating people over the head, but pointing out what OSHA would consider to be a problem. And that's what we're going to do today. There's a lot of elements of your properties and your marinas that you may overlook or you may not look at in the same eye that OSHA looks at. First and foremost, I want to tell you that you're not likely to see an inspection, but you might. So working on OSHA standards on your properties, doing the training, and conforming to the standards that OSHA sets forth is nothing but a win-win situation all across the board. I will tell you this, I've trained a lot of people in our organization, our drivers, respirator training. I do property site inspections where I sit the teams down and I go over all of the shortfalls that I see on the properties. And I can tell you without any doubt in my mind whatsoever that 100% of the people that I work with at the properties are very well, they receive the information, they love the training, they embrace the training. I am really encouraged because generally when I leave a property after doing an inspection, I get a lot of emails from the general manager, the teams, the service managers, anybody on the property, because now they're looking at what they're doing in a different light. And they're asking about how they can correct things. That's number one. Number two, the majority of your corrections on the properties can probably be done very economically. We're not talking about having to spend a lot of money. It's really eyes open. There's a lot of simple elements that you can correct on the properties that will improve how you are positioned if OSHA were to show up on the property. Excuse me. Along the lines of showing up on the property, show of hands, anybody had an OSHA inspection on their properties in this room? Nobody. I have. I've been involved with three inspections at three different properties starting way back in 1999 for a big property I was operating in Boston called Marina Bay. We had OSHA inspectors. As it turns out, the OSHA inspectors were running out of work because they were concluding a very large construction project called the Big Dig up in Boston. I'm sure everybody's heard about that. So one day at the property, we had six OSHA inspectors just show up out of the clear blue sky. By the time they were done with us, they'd written up $500,000 worth of violations on the property. And as you can understand, $500,000 cuts into the bottom line quite a bit. Granted, we were able to negotiate away a majority of it, but we still ended up with about $50,000 worth of fines. A lot of flaws that we could have corrected easily. I'll give you one example. On the property, we had violations that OSHA wrote up for almost 100 ladders that were on the property that were in some way, shape, or form either defective, broken, not managed correctly, or whatever you want to call it. We stored 500 boats on the property, and OSHA wrote us up for every 2x4s nailed together that some owner was using to get up on his boat. So there's that. You may see an inspection, you may not. It may happen accidentally. There was a recent inspection of a marina property in Virginia, if I'm not mistaken, where the OSHA inspectors happened to drive into the wrong driveway. They were looking for a commercial barge for a bridge building company, and they drove into the wrong property, and they ended up parking in the marina, and they walked around the marina, and they wrote the owner up for a lot of violations. I want to stop real quick. I work for a private company. I'm available to help anyone in the room with questions you might have. I have cards up here. I'm happy to give you one of my cards if you have a question about either the presentation or something going on the property. But as far as working for other people in the industry, obviously I'm restricted because I am employed by Suntex Marinas. However, my colleague, Robert Smith, right here, Robert, raise your hand. Robert works for a group that does this professionally. He can come to your property. He can help you with whatever you need, be it training, inspections, or, you know, God forbid, some kind of legal implications because of a violation. So they may show up. They may not show up. You may never see them. But like anything else in the world, it's like insurance. You don't pay for insurance because you think you're going to have an accident. You pay for insurance because you're concerned you might have an accident. We attack our OSHA problems because we are concerned that if we do get an inspection, we want to make sure, one, that the teams are protected, and two, that the property is protected and that we know what we're doing. The other element that we discovered, Suntex discovered, once we started doing this was our underwriter for Workman's Comp is actually giving us a discount on our portfolio coverage across the board, because we do have an internal risk management program where we watch what we're doing and we manage the accidents and we manage the health of our team members. Good morning. So anyway, to get started. Does everybody know what OSHA's mandate is? What are they here for? They are in place exclusively to protect the workers in the United States. A property inspection will get triggered automatically if there is a fatality or workplace catastrophe resulting in a worker injury, complaints registered by employees. We've all heard about disgruntled employees. Well, they can dime OSHA and turn you in in a heartbeat. Referrals from other agencies. Follow-up inspections. If you have an OSHA violation, they will be back and they will manage it and monitor it. Planned or program investigation of targeted industries. It was just like I was saying a little while ago. OSHA seems to be becoming more involved and more focused on our industry as well as a lot of other industries. On my way down here, I was talking to a gentleman on an airplane, and he mentioned to me that when he found out what I did, he kind of shook his head and said, I've had more trouble with OSHA recently. When I asked him why, he said, well, I build houses. I'm a housing developer. I do small developments, maybe 20 or 30 houses. Pardon me. And in the last 2 or 3 years, his inspections have ramped up considerably, where the inspectors are showing up in his developments and they are looking at everything that he does. And this is small housing. We're not talking about major skyscrapers or large projects or whatever. We're talking about a guy who builds 10, 20, or 30 small houses. And he has had multiple inspections and unfortunately has gotten written up for violations. Excuse me. If an investigator arrives on your property, you should train your teams what to do. The first thing that everybody should know is that the OSHA inspector is not allowed to walk around by himself. He has to be accompanied by somebody from the property, either the manager on duty, general manager, or someone appointed as a safety manager. You can ask the inspector to wait for that person while you contact the GM if they're not on the property that day or if they're not easily accessible, but you cannot delay it. And there's a bunch of different steps that you should know. Can't take more than an hour if you're looking for the GM. The inspector, accompanied by a member of management, will tour the site. Do not allow the investigator to tour the site solo. This is your right. They used to have the right of coming onto the property and not letting anybody know that they were there and wandering around. They can't do that anymore. But they have the right to inspect the property. Make sure your teams are aware. Don't comment, provide personal thoughts, or apologize for anything that the inspector might bring up. That doesn't do us any good whatsoever. And by the way, anybody has any questions, just stop me and ask the question rather than waiting towards the end, please. As I said in the beginning, this is about education. These are the flaws that I see consistently across the board at different marina properties. Fire extinguishers seem to be the number one. Either they're mounted incorrectly, they're out of compliance, the signs are wrong, they're blocked. I see that a lot. You have an extinguisher mounted somewhere and it's got all kinds of crap piled in front of it. That's a big problem as far as we should be considering that a huge problem, and OSHA will consider it to be a big problem. Building exits. If you have doorways inside the buildings that are not marked as a door that doesn't go anywhere, should be marked very clearly. This is not an exit. Obviously, the rest of them are marked as fire exits. Fire plans, I see that as a big flaw. We don't have a written fire plan. We don't have fire drills. We don't, in general, the teams have a go-to plan. This became very obvious recently. I don't know if anybody saw the articles on these two big yachts that burned in Fort Lauderdale. Basically, they did not have a fire plan in that yard. So nobody, even though it was after hours, nobody knew what the heck to do. And it took them such a long time before somebody actually was contacting the right people, dialing 911, doing everything they needed to do. Hazardous communications, another one. Powered equipment training. Any equipment that you have on the property, your drivers need to be trained. Travel lifts, forklifts, small pallet lifts, supposed to be trained. There should be some kind of training if you use backhoes on a regular basis or if you have tractors. Tractors kind of fall under agriculture, but they also fall under hauling. So then you've got ABYC standards that come into play. OSHA 300 logs, we touched on that. Yesterday, or Robert's panel touched on that briefly yesterday. Electrical panels. I see a lot of electrical panels. The doors are off them. They've got open circuits where they're not blocked, where somebody pulled a circuit breaker out of a panel and it's got a nice big hole right there. Machine guarding. It's everything you can possibly have in the shop. If you have a service or a maintenance area and you can tell me with absolute honesty at this point that you know for a fact that your bench grinder has 100%, I would find it hard to believe because I see them all the time. They pull the guards off them and they throw them away. They pull the tool rests off them and they throw away. And then they got a nice big stone that's hanging out there because they needed to get at it from some other angle. That's a violation. PPE is another one, personal protection equipment. Respirator training. I do all the respirator training for our teams on the properties. I have to actually go there. There is a medical test that the person using the respirator is supposed to take. You can do it online. It's pretty simple. But they do have to take the medical test to verify that they can actually use the respirator. And then I go to the properties and I do a fit test with the respirator. Battery charging is another one. I see batteries all over the place. Chargers everywhere, batteries sitting out on the floor, chargers running, batteries bubbling away. Extremely dangerous. As a technician, I've had batteries explode in my face a couple of times back in my early days. Only has to happen to you once, and then it'll never happen again. Open flame is a big one that's going to get more impact as we go along. NFPA states that we shouldn't have grills or heaters or any kind of open flame on our slips out in the marina. And I know for a fact, I can tell you right now, that if I ask for a show of hands, I'm sure most of you would raise your hands and say, my customers have grills out on the marina. They have them next to their boats. They have them on the docks. I've seen properties where people actually rent the slip next to them and build it all out, and there's a full-service kitchen in the thing. It's not acceptable. It's just the way it is. OSHA frowns on it as well because it puts our employees at risk. Eyewash station is going to be another big one we're going to start seeing more and more of. NFPA, you're supposed to have an eyewash station on your gas dock. It should be within a certain distance from the dispensers. Gasoline is considered to be a corrosive. We all have summer staff. We've all seen the gas spurt up out of a fill for whatever reason. They're not wearing eye protection. They could get gasoline in their eyes. OSHA wants you to have a eyewash station wherever you're charging batteries, in the service departments, on the gas docks. Doesn't necessarily have to be hard plumbed. It can be one of these standalone units that bolt to the wall. It just has to be installed correctly. And most importantly, you have to train everyone in its use. They have to know how to use it, not necessarily that it's just sitting there. Again, seasonal staff, you have to bring them in, train them how to use it. I'll go back to PPE for real quick. The other one is with personal protection equipment is pump outs. I can't tell you how many times I've seen seasonal staff doing a pump out. All the seasonal staff members want to do the pump out because they're all getting tips out of it, so there's a competition. But they don't use gloves. They're not wearing eye protection. I've seen these young kids pumping out a boat, put the hose away, and then go proceed to either smoke a cigarette or eat a sandwich without washing their hands. Happens all the time because they're not trained. They don't understand what the implications are. An 18, 19-year-old kid really doesn't get it. It's that mythical invincibility of youth as far as it goes. Fire extinguishers, as I said before, the biggest one I see is fired, not tagged out, then signage and mounting. OSHA requires extinguishers to be 3.5 feet off the floor, well signed. They're getting ready to, NFPA is getting ready to change some of the sign requirements where they're looking for a 180-degree view of an extinguisher, which is going to require a triangular sign above the extinguisher, not necessarily just a flat-mounted extinguisher sign. The other one is fire safety, blocked escape routes. That's a big one. I see it all the time. There's a small office. You've got an exit, and right in front of it is six boxes of files piled up against the door. It happens, but it is a violation. You need a fire plan. You need to do fire drills with your local fire department. Always easy. You ask them to come in, they'll be happy to help you in any way. You don't have to worry about it. It's not like they're going to come in and write you up for a bunch of code violations, unless you have a bunch of code violations that you're concerned about. If you do, then you should be correcting those anyway. Does that look familiar? Anybody got a service department? Anybody got a maintenance department? You might have a couple of workbenches and you've got all kinds of stuff piled up all over the place. You've got flammables, you've got gasoline, you've got all kinds of different things. Everything should be in fire cabinets. One of my big triggers these days with my properties is I'm looking to see, we have a lot of boat rental operations. They do a lot of boat cleaning. And what I'm finding is they're commingling cleaning materials. They're putting all different kinds of cleaning materials, liquids together on their storage shelves. Well, there was a very serious accident in Massachusetts just recently. I don't know if anybody saw it. A team at one of the Buffalo Wild Wings restaurants, I don't know if I'm supposed to say it or not, but one of the team members who hadn't been trained was cleaning the floor in the kitchen. He put down an acid cleaner, and then he figured, you know what, it'd be great. I'll throw some of this other stuff on top of it so it'll really do a great job. Well, he combined an acid with a bleach, and when you do that, it creates chlorine gas immediately. There was a chemical reaction. The employee basically lost his mind and freaked out, ran out of the room. The general manager came in and tried to mop, squeegee all of the liquid out of the room, and he was overcome by the fumes, and he later died. This is a young guy, he's 28 years old, had four kids, and he died because there was a chemical accident in the marina. Back to my original point, I am training our teams now. You need to keep the bleach separate from the acid. How many facilities out here use on-off? On-off is an acid. You also probably use bleach to clean boats or clean another area. If you combine those two products together, you'll get chlorine gas immediately and you'll kill somebody. It's that simple, and it happens that fast. It's one of those things. Education and knowledge, same deal. You don't want to terrify people, but at the same time, it is our obligation to make sure that the teams understand what they're working with so that they can be proactive about how they do things as well. SDS management's another big one. Really, really simple. I hope everyone in the room is at least partially focused on managing your safety data sheets. That's the new term that OSHA's using now. No more MSDS, it's all SDS. You can get the sheets themselves from each property needs to be responsible for the sheets. SDS must be provided one time by the supplier upon request. Anybody who's supplying you materials that are considered to be, in this day and age, somehow hazardous, and believe it or not, WD-40 is on that list. If you have a supplier who's sending you materials you're ordering stuff from, they're supposed to give you the option of asking for the sheet. I always advise everyone, ask them for the sheet. I get the question a lot, well, there's a digital library that the supplier has. Okay, the digital library is fine and dandy. However, as far as OSHA is concerned, that digital library must be accessible by anyone on the property, be it an employee, a customer, management, or anyone else. So OSHA inspector shows up on the property and you've got Johnny behind the counter in the store, and the OSHA guy walks in and says, I'd like to see the general manager. And the general manager comes out and he says, okay, I need to see your SDS sheets. And the general manager, for some reason, doesn't have access to a computer, can't get online, can't get to that library, or even worse, the GM's not there and it's just Johnny, and Johnny really doesn't know how to get to that library. He cannot access the library of SDS sheets, and right behind him on the shelves is a whole bunch of products that should be part of that. The simplest thing you can do is get the hard copy, put them in a binder. They're available from Amazon for about $80. It's a big yellow plastic binder. It's got a holder. It's got a little chain on it so nobody can walk off with it. And you can mount it right behind the counter. That takes care of that problem. HAZCOM, we talked about a moment ago. You must have a hazardous communication program. You must communicate it to all your people. You have to have regular training on a monthly basis of what you're doing on the property and what's hazardous to them. If you have bottom pain operation, as an example, you must supply them with a respirator, but you also got to tell them what they're using because of the nastiness of all these bottom pains. Even the modern ones, they still are nasty. There's a lot of nasty chemicals out there that they're using. Spraying paint, working with lubricants, doing anything else. Gasoline is considered to be a toxic material. I've been changing oil for 45 years, but I can't tell you the last time I wore gloves when I changed oil. It's just one of those things. I just don't do it. Why? Maybe I'm stupid. It's possible. Part of your team meeting. You should have a monthly team meeting on your site and document it. You have a little handout sheet. You pass it around, and every month you have a different topic. Maybe this month it's extinguisher mounting. Maybe next month it's hazardous communication, materials, bottom pain, SDS sheets. There's a whole myriad of things you can talk about with the team. One hour a month, have them memorialize it, write it down on your little log sheet, put it in a binder. OSHA comes in and says, do you train your people? You show them the binder. They flip through it. They check a box. They say, great, wonderful. Move on from there. Powered equipment training. We talked about that a moment ago. Show of hands, how many people in the room have equipment on your properties? What kind of equipment do you have on your properties? Boat forklifts, travel lifts, small pallet lifts, hydraulic trailers, tractors, pickup trucks pulling a hydraulic trailer. All that requires training. How many of you folks who raised your hand that have equipment have training done by an official OSHA trainer? I don't know. Guys are in trouble out there. It's easy to get it done. This is another thing that Robert can help you with. You get the trainer to come in. I do the training for all of our drivers. It takes about 2 hours for me to run half a dozen drivers through. Once we do it, we are covered. And I'm talking about everything. We do small pallet lifts. We do hydraulic trailers. We do travel lifts. And we move a lot of boats around. We have a lot of forklifts in the system. We have a lot of equipment in the system. Different places, different equipment. But it is something that you have to have done. Guess what the number one violation is that OSHA writes people up for with powered equipment? Take a guess. Seat belts. Drivers never put the seat belts on. The seat belt rule is an offshoot from the warehouse industry. OSHA wants all those warehouse forklift drivers strapped into the machines. Right now, if you take a moment, think about how many warehouses there are in the United States. There's millions of them. Some of them are gigantic. They're the size of a small city. And in every one of those warehouses, you have all these pallet lifts running around with all these drivers. And they have accidents every day. Every day, there's hundreds of forklift accidents. You don't hear about them, but every day, there's hundreds of forklift accidents. OSHA wants people strapped into the machine because accidents happen with the machine actually rolling over. A guy drives off of a loading dock, goes around a corner too fast, drives off an edge. That opening slide that you saw at the beginning of my presentation was actually a boat forklift where the guy drove off the edge of a load ramp right at the edge of the drop well, and the machine flipped over on its side. And unfortunately, the guy wasn't strapped in, and he got killed. And he also had a fuel spill, and they had the boat on fire, and all kinds of catastrophe. But number one is seatbelts. Number two is daily inspections. Every time you use a piece of equipment, you're supposed to do a daily inspection. The driver should be trained to go out and do a daily inspection. You don't have to do a daily inspection of the equipment every day if you're not using it, but if you are using it, the driver has to sign off on a sheet. It has to go to the supervisor and go in a file. This is all part of OSHA's oversight. If they come in and ask you for your inspection logs and you have six pieces of equipment on the property, you better have six pieces of paperwork in a file somewhere for every time that the machine was used. Lockout tags is another one. You got a piece of equipment that's out of service. I see it all the time. There's a machine with a tire off of it on the right-hand side. You can't see it when you walk up to the machine. The keys are in the machine. Someone could conceivably jump in, fire it up, and try to drive it away. I've seen it happen. Lockout, tagouts. Take the keys out, lock it out. Same thing with electrical panels. Same thing with anything dangerous. If you're working on something somewhere in the facility and you don't lock out a panel with a tag, it's a simple enough step. Again, it's part of the training. The maintenance guys should know how to do this. Anyone who's fooling around with anything on site should be able to do it. That's just the way it is. There's also digital daily inspections available. If you have a lot of equipment and you want to go to a digital app, that's an option. Me personally, I like the piece of paper. It's real simple. It's easy to train the drivers how to fill out a form, hand it back to someone in the office who puts it in a file. OSHA 300 log. Robert touched on this yesterday in his seminar. And unless somebody's got a specific question about 300 logs, I'm just going to move through this because I think he covered pretty much what the implications are. My two with my properties is make sure you've got the log. As of January 1, it has to be up until, I believe, April 14th. February 1, 30th, April. My apologies. February 1, 30th of April. Even if you have not had an accident in the prior year, do yourselves a favor. Fill out the OSHA log and write across it, no accidents in 2018 or 2019 or whenever it might have been. Post it for a few months, take it down, and just as important, put it in a file. You're supposed to keep them for 5 years. It's another one of those things. If you have an inspection, if the inspector asks for the OSHA 300 log file, Robert? Correct. Good point. If you're a small company, you've got 10 or under employees, you don't have to file the OSHA log. The other thing with 10 or under employees, I think it's 10 or under for training, for memorializing training.
It's a difference. So with that, when you're considered that small business category for your training element, we can all gather around the conference room table.
Right. Right. You can do it verbally when you're a small company. You don't have to have handouts. You don't have to memorialize it. However, you do need to be aware that someone shows up and asks you the questions, you need to be able to put hand on heart and say, yes, we do training. We only do it verbally because we only have six people working for us. Machine guarding. The one thing I can tell you that in my experience, as I've told everybody on the properties, is we have a lot of pack rats in our business. We have a lot of guys who hang on to equipment even though it's obsolete, past its useful life, broken cord, broken case. My counsel to everyone is if you have an old piece of equipment that you never use but you seem to be hanging on to it forever, get rid of it. Because if you get an inspection, they come in, they don't care that it's an old piece. You can tell them all day long, well, we never used that. They're going to write you up for it. Say, okay, well, it's still a violation because they're on the property. They could fire it up, cut their arm off. Get rid of the old stuff. And there's a lot of simple stuff with hand tools. I'm sure everyone has seen this kind of thing with hand tools. Respiration we talked about. You need to supply them with respirators. Eye protection, hearing protection, hand protection, gloves, earplugs, respirators. It is in the employer's best interest to supply the respirators and the cartridges so that the employees are covered and make sure they wear them. I mean, I've been in facilities where we give guys brand new respirators, and they don't use them. It's important that they use them, and they need to be trained and understand the importance of the equipment and why we want them to do it. You know, guys, from once, believe it or not, the mystical invincibility of youth. We didn't wear respirators because we thought it was a pain in the ass, and it got in the way of the cigarette that we were smoking while we were working on a customer's boat. Well, those are the old days. That's all gone now. So. Yeah, it is the law. We have to supply them with the respirators, the training, the cartridges, the PPE in general, and everything that goes along with it. We have to supply it to them. And we also have to manage, you know, my point was, it's hard to manage some guys because they refuse to wear them, but you have to manage that relationship. They have to understand why. equipment we talked about. These are all big ones. Broken outlets. I learned something yesterday sitting through the National Electric Code seminar about outlets, GFCIs, and that we're supposed to be testing them on a monthly basis. How many people have GFCIs in their marinas? A lot, right? We all have them. Do we test them? Do we send somebody around to push the button on a regular basis and then record it in a log? I mean, I don't think I know of any property that does that, but I can tell you going forward from here, my guys are going to hate me even more because now I'm going to tell them, okay, this should be part of your monthly inspection of the property, is you should be going out there and testing your GFCIs. This was something I picked up a few weeks ago. This is top 10 OSHA violations in 2018, starting at the top, working towards the bottom. And you can see, you know, just in general, think about which one of these falls in your marina. That one does, that one does, that one does, that one. Lockout, tagout, ladders, industrial trucks, training requirements for fall protection, machine guarding, PPE. So it looks like all 10 of them would be potential violations that you could have in your property. And these are actually write-ups out in the world. Thousands and thousands and thousands of them. Fall protection, most of it happens in the construction industry. HAZCOM and SDS could be manufacturing, could be any one of a number of places. Scaffolding, again, in the construction industry. But if you do boat repairs and you have boats in your buildings and you have sailboats, you got to have scaffolding, right? If you have scaffolding, you got to have fall protection. If your workers are higher than, I think it's 4 feet, 5 feet, and 6 feet. 4 feet is for the manufacturing business, 5 feet is maritime, and 6 feet is construction. If your employee is more than 6 feet off the ground, needs to have fall protection. Not on a ladder, but on a scaffold or when they're working anywhere. This is a big one too. Whether you realize it or not, you are responsible as the property owner, you are responsible for subcontractors, for your tenants, and for all of their activities on the property. You have a guy working on a roof, and that's a guy, and I will be the first one to acknowledge, that's a guy working on a roof at one of the Suntex properties that I happen to be at. And right after I saw that, we had an intervention with the contractor, and the next day they went up there and they did what they were supposed to do. Flaws. He has no perimeter guide around the edge of the building or in open holes anywhere. He's not wearing fall protection. He doesn't have the roof fall protection. He's just up there wandering around. Well, that's a problem. He falls off that roof, and I can be very confident when I tell you that you are going to be involved in a lawsuit. His carrier is going to come after us, or you as the property owner. Your insurance company is going to get involved in some way, shape, or form, and it's not going to end well. Workman's comp is another one. If you are not collecting workman's comp from every sub that works on your property, you have a problem. There is a rule in Florida right now where the sole ownership of a business doesn't have to supply workman's comp. Well, I can tell you that may be the case at other properties, but not at the Suntex properties. We do not adhere to that standard. When we put it in place about a year ago, when we started reviewing and we found out that we had actual business owners out there who were working on our properties, and I'm talking about working on our properties in a big way, detailers working on boats, guys doing some heavy work like putting up a tower or something like this on a sport fish, and you have a person who says, I don't have to have workman's comp, that's not the case. We insist on workman's comp. Why? Because that person falls off of a sport fish tower and he's 35 feet up in the air and bounces off the deck and lands on the ground, guess what? You are going to be involved in a lawsuit. Your insurance company is going to get drawn into a lawsuit. His heirs are going to sue you and the property for his damages, for his, God forbid he dies, but for his medical bills and for his loss of wages and everything that goes along with it. And he can say to you all day long, I don't have to have comp, and that's not true. That is absolutely not true. And, you know, given the environment we live in with lawsuits today, you would be foolish as an owner of a property not to insist that everyone have comp. And that goes for your tenants as well. You got to be careful about your tenants. You have some tenant on the property. Maybe it's a service tenant. Maybe it's someone who rents boats. Maybe it's someone who does whatever. And all of a sudden, one of their guys comes along and jumps in your pallet lift to unload an engine from the back of a truck, and he gets hurt, you're going to get sued. He was not trained on that piece of equipment. There is no certificate showing he was trained. You're going to get sued. It's far-reaching. And again, not trying to scare anybody, but being aware of all of this is what it's really all about in this day and age. Yes, sir. You will still be drawn in, but at least you'll have some coverage. You'll have some, you know, you'll have a risk management entity on your side. You know, you'll have something. If they don't have anything, then his attorney or his legal counsel is going to turn around. They're going to come right back to you for 100%. It's just the way it is. You know. You're protecting your property. That's what you're trying to do. Just like anything else. You protect your property by making sure your fire extinguishers are certified. You protect your property by making sure you don't have a bunch of open circuits laying around in your shop. You protect your property by making sure you're, you know, not pumping gasoline out of 5-gallon cans into a piece of equipment somewhere. You're just protecting the property. It's the same thing with comp. It's truly the same thing. And there, I hate to say this, but as soon as an accident happens, there are all these people in the world who want to take advantage of that accident. It's just the nature of, it's human nature these days. There's all this legal support that you can get that says you are the injured person and that we have XYZ company, especially with a company like Suntex. We have a lot of exposure because we're a big company. There's a lot of equity in the company. So people immediately assume that they can sue us for who knows what. But being that we're protected, maybe they're not going to be so quick to sue. You never know. Again, it's all about protection. It's insurance, essentially. Making sure that your teams are educated, making sure that your properties are as secure as possible, making sure that you know what's going on out there. Everyone gets their training. It's just good business in this day and age. And again, monetarily, monetarily, your underwriter may say to you, well, you have a comprehensive program. You have all these written safeties. You do your training. Your teams are, well-educated. Great, we're going to show you that we value that with a discount of some kind on your underwriting. And the other side of it is morale, showing the teams that we really, really care about them, not putting them in harm's way. That's the biggest thing. I get that from my guys all the time. We really appreciate you. We really appreciate what you're doing. And that's about it for the presentation. The only other thing I wanted to touch on real briefly is if you're not managing, and the gentleman who ran the NEC, the National Electric Code Standards yesterday touched on it, if you're not managing your electroshock death, current leakage in the marinas, and when I say managing, it is going around and monitoring every shore power cable that's plugged in. If you're not doing that, then you're missing the boat. It's a simple process. It's a piece of equipment. It's $250. If you have big 50-amp shore power cords, the piece of equipment will run you about $800. I'm going to check with him today because I believe, maybe Robert, you know this, I believe that the new NEC, National Electric Code Standards, that are coming out for 2020 will have a standard in there that directs us as marina owners to be checking and memorializing shore power on a monthly basis. We are going to be obligated to start recording what the shore power readings are for these boats that are out in the marina. And I never realized what a huge problem it was in general until I started managing it for our company. And I can tell you right here and now, I've seen a lot, and I mean a lot, of vessels that have serious problems. That you it's silent killer. It's like carbon monoxide. You never know there's a problem with current leakage until somebody is either hurt or dies. And it happens all the time, and there's more visibility. And again, think about it this way. You're protecting your property. You're protecting your business. You're going out there and you're managing and monitoring. And my guys are now all looking. All the GMs are equipped and they're all watching. And when they find a problem, they go to the owner and they tell him, you have a problem on board your vessel. Half of the time, the owner reacts in an excited manner that it's not his boat or her boat, it's the marina. But I will tell you this, 99.9% of the time, by the time we get done looking at it, it turns out it is the boat. It is not the marina. It's not the power supply. Something is wrong on the boat. Especially if you have a property that's on a freshwater lake where you have a lot of older boats, where you have people who've considered themselves to be electricians, or they have friends who considers themselves to be electricians, and they've done work on the boats, and they've done it maybe not in the manner that's, absolutely correct to an ABYC standard. ABYC directs all electrical AC systems. The neutrals should not be connected to the bonding systems, but I see it all the time. I see the neutrals connected to the bonding systems. I see the ground wires in the wrong places. I see all kinds of things. Older equipment down in the bilge is the number one cause for a problem. You have a neutral that's tied to a case somewhere, and you have some kind of a flaw in the equipment, and you're directing AC current into the water. And some of it's considerable. I did an inspection about a month and a half ago where I found two boats that had in excess of an amp and a half of current leakage going into the water. That's 1,500 milliamps. That's enough to fry somebody going over the side. Good news is, once we told the owners about it, they were very proactive about it. They asked for help. We got the service teams in there. We got an electrician in there, and they were able to solve the problems. And it was what I was saying. It was a piece of equipment on both boats. One was an inverter that was shorted out that was laying in a puddle of water in the bottom of the boat, and the other one was an older air conditioning unit that didn't show a current leakage until the unit would try to start and the capacitor would really jazz up the compressor, and all of a sudden you could sit there and watch the meter and it would just charge up. It would go from about 180 milliamps, it would just charge right up to almost 1500 milliamps because of all that current that was just pouring out into the water around the boat. That's it. Questions? Thank you all.
Thanks.
Have a great day. Robert, I get 20%.